Hey everyone, welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs. I'm your host, Katie Harbath. Today, I am bringing you a conversation that I'm having with Nate Persily. Nate is the James B. McClatchy Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, and he has appointments in the departments of political science, communication, and the Freeman Spogli Institute of International Studies. He's also the founding co-director of the Stanford Cyber Policy Center, its program on democracy on the internet, as well as the Stanford MIT Healthy Elections Project. I've known Nate now for many years. He is the forefront expert at this combination of research, technology, election administration, transparency. He has been at the forefront of so much of this work that has happened. And so our conversation really covers a wide span of topics from social media to artificial intelligence, to transparency laws, to the Digital Services Act, to the Supreme Court cases, and election administration. So I hope you enjoy. Nate, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start off first by having you just introduce yourself to folks who might not be familiar with you and your work.
Okay, I'm Nate Persily. I'm a law professor here at Stanford and also run the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. I sort of have two main areas of work. One is on sort of the law of democracy and things like voting rights and election administration. And then I work a lot on the sort of intersection of tech and democracy. So all of the stuff that you did when you were in the industry is what I've been studying for the last decade or so.
Yeah, and I wanted to go back. We were trying to figure out exactly when we first met. We think it's somewhere in the 2013, 2014 timeframe, but we're not entirely sure. But you brought a group of us together at Stanford with the Federal Election Commission. I think I had only been at Facebook for a few years. Can you share a little bit about that gathering, why you wanted to do it? Because I think that it's important as we kind of look at where we are today, you know, 10 years later, and everything that has changed, it's kind of important for folks to know sort of what these conversations looked like back then.
So when I was teaching at Columbia in 2013, and I had just been appointed to be the research director of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. This was the commission that President Obama put together to deal with like long lines on election day and all kinds of things related to the 2012 election. And so I was appointed by the two lawyers for the campaign, Bob Bauer, who was the White House counsel under Obama, and Ben Ginsburg, who was Mitt Romney's lawyer. And we spent the year in 2013 working on this report with this commission on all things related to the electoral system. And then that was released in January 2014. And we wanted to do something that it was sort of the last real bipartisan attempt to deal with elections in the U.S. and had some success with that. And Bob, Ben, and I were thinking about, well, what would we do next? And we all had sort of an interest in campaign finance. And so we said, since I was moving to Stanford, we said, well, what's one of the biggest sort of campaign finance issues, or emerging campaign finance issues? And we said, all right, let's think about how tech is going to influence campaign finance and political advertising. And so what we did was the first thing that I sort of organized when I came to Stanford was this session with the FEC, the Republican and Democratic data people, and then people like you from the platforms. And this was a sort of an amazing experience. It was sort of a crazy time because as now, but even it seemed more so then, the FEC was so divided along partisan lines that they couldn't even agree whether to have bagels or donuts in the like morning break room. I'll let you guess which party went which way on that. But so we just to get them to come to Silicon Valley together, we had to do all this kind of diplomacy. But it started both me and sort of my group at Stanford thinking about the effect of tech on political communication. And that's where I met you, met some folks from Google. And then, you know, the rest is history. I mean, it started there. This is before the 2016 election, when people were still thinking of tech as this magical elixir that was drunk by the sort of Obama Jedi campaigners. Who did all the data crunching and everything.
As you're talking about that, I was like, if we could only take a time machine and go back to that meeting and tell everyone what we were in for and what we should start planning for political ad transparency and all those things back then, like that would be, it'd be interesting to go back to our old selves and be like, you have no idea what's about to come down the pike.
Well, it's funny because the folks from Google who were there, at least one of them is still at Google. And that session actually led to work I did with the Bipartisan Policy Center to help Google think about not just ad transparency, but sort of regulation of political ads generally on the platform. So we held a series of meetings after that in DC and elsewhere, and came up with some, you know, reasonable proposals on transparency and disclosure and disclaimers, all of which was shelved until after the 2016 election. And now we're all, you know, sort of familiar with the changes the platform's made since then.
I didn't know that. That's very cool. So fast forwarding now to today, and your work continues to kind of look at that impact of social media and politics, but now also artificial intelligence. And so we'll keep digging into this because it's kind of a lot to ask about major themes, but I've been kind of looking back to of like the last 20 years of just how all of this has evolved and how we might learn from that as we go into this next age of AI. And I'm wondering what some of the themes are that you've seen and how that's starting to impact your work as you're now starting to look at artificial intelligence and how that is being used in elections.
So we just started a new program over the last year in the Cyber Policy Center called the Program on Governance of Emerging Technologies. It's being led by Professor Florence Giselle, who's holds the digital governance chair at Sciences Po in Paris. And so it's looking at, you know, many emerging technologies, VR, blockchain, but all, in particular, AI. And so we'll have a gigantic report coming out in about a month on governance of generative AI. Now, the as you said, my focus is on the effect of AI and elections. And I think I've been sort of listening to the way you've been talking about it. And I generally, I think, agree. My one fear, though, which is a little different, I think, than the way you and others have been covering it, is that we are sort of trying to graft wholesale the cognitive boxes that we developed in the realm of social media onto this new technology. And I think AI is different than social media and search, right? It's a much bigger deal. And so when we talk about the impact of AI and democracy, we naturally gravitate to a model that we developed, you know, following Facebook in 2016, which I think is can be distracting. You know, yes, there's a disinformation problem. Yes, there's a bias problem, an antitrust problem, a privacy problem, right? There are sort of similarities between this and other tech contexts, but it's a very different family of technologies that we're talking about. And it's their the impacts on democracy are going to be different and in some ways much more profound.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, the 4 weeks I spent out in California here in February really made me realize just how different AI is. And I'll fully admit, I'm still trying to get my head fully wrapped around that and trying to think about that differently and not putting those same structures, like you said, that we had for social media and others on top of that. And then also trying to think about how do I help, you know, folks here in DC and others, like they're also still in those constructs. And now asking people to completely kind of reshift their thinking and looking at this from a different perspective is going to be quite a challenge as we go through this. I'm curious if there's ways that you've seen, like, what are the ways that you're explaining it to people when you're, you know, out at a dinner party or something like that? How should people be thinking about it differently?
Well, I would say, it turned into a dinner party, but I gave a talk to the National Conference of State Legislatures recently on this topic. And what I said is that, look, you know, AI will accentuate the abilities of all good and bad actors in the system to achieve the same goals that they've always had, right? And so that's true whether it's a foreign actor or a domestic actor, whether someone who's trying to suppress the vote or trying to do voter turnout operations. Reid Hoffman calls AI a steam engine for the mind, and I think that's right, which is that any task that any actor in the system has been performing that has a digital component now has an AI component to it. And we're only at the beginning of thinking through those implications. Of course, you know, everybody immediately thinks about the deepfakes and disinformation problem related to AI. And, you know, we should spend time thinking about that. But, you know, it's so much more than that, right? It's both on the risk side and on the opportunity side, because it's not even clear when we say sort of AI's risks to democracy, what all are we talking about? You know, all of the existential risks that people talk about related to AI have a democracy side to them as well. So you take something like enhancing the abilities of like cyber attacks, right? The cybersecurity issues. You know, if you take down the electrical grid, that is that's an election and democracy problem as well. All of the capacities that are accentuated by AI have a kind of democracy component.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that, it's just very interesting to see where this is all going to go. And it's kind of crazy that we're doing this during the biggest year of elections around the globe and all of this. And you mentioned a little bit about some of the things that concern you and what give you hope, but I'm wondering if you've got any specific examples of things. Like, I'll give it, for instance, for me, deep fake audio seems to me as something, especially for down ballot races, is something that could be potentially be one of those things that do sort of concern me because there's not as much fact checking and stuff there. But I've also seen a lot of really great hope for AI for people that, are jailed in opposition voices. We saw that in Pakistan. Or, I frankly just to help do my job faster and help campaigns. Right. Like, I remember that. I'm curious from your perspective, like, what are the things you're kind of excited about? And are there things you're particularly concerned about?
So I am concerned about the video and the audio tools that you mentioned. Most of those concerns, though, revolve around kind of one-to-one communications using AI as opposed to the sort of broad dissemination of things like deep fakes. Now, I think you sort of hit the nail on the head when you said, I'm concerned about this AI in down ballot races, right? And so that's true for any aspect of, disinformation. And I think AI is a good example of that. Now, so what AI does is that, yes, it may be through deep fakes or other kinds of synthetic media could have an effect on a targeted group of people, say, where there's no information in the election, right? All of these technologies, when you deal with something like the presidential election in the U.S., where there's huge amount of media coverage and a lot of sort of pluralism in the information sources, right? I think they're going to have less of an impact. But when you have low information elections, like down ballot elections, this is true with respect to advertising, and then with respect to this kind of content. Now, I have been thinking about the use of AI in the kind of election administration system, and so what it does, all of the things that we might be using AI for right now in the creation of text or messaging, right? There's an election administration component to that. So if you're a state election director or just a local election director, GPT, ChatGPT will help you just as it helps a middle school a student who wants to fabricate a paper, right? And so all the kind of voter turnout, voter information work can be accentuated. But it's more than that. All the kinds of work that you do for like anomaly detection, whether it's to detect voter fraud or to detect, or resource allocation for polling places, all of that is going to be assisted with AI. And then the general point, which is what you're saying about where the threats might be with the low information elections, as is true with social media, what AI does is it lowers the cost of certain things. And those candidates that are not well funded now have, increased capacity to do things like, generate commercials or other kinds of advertising, or to use it for voter targeting, voter turnout operations. All of that stuff now just got a lot cheaper because you don't need to employ an army of consultants. You can use some of these new tech tools.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited about thinking about how election officials and others, it'll be many years down the road, but with all the data and stuff that they have, is there the ability to help think about how to make lines shorter, but better places to put precincts, places for them to vote, all of that kind of stuff. But shifting back to social media, I want to go into another topic that you've been very involved in, which is requiring more transparency of the platforms. You were very much at the forefront of trying to work with Meta on that. Recently, they announced that they're finally going to end CrowdTangle, which was a tool that many were using in order to monitor what was happening on the platform. But I'm wondering if you can go back first and share a little bit about that initial project with Meta and sort of some of the things that you learned from that and what happened.
So I had been part of a group of academics that had gone to, all of these sort of outreach events that then Facebook had been holding on trying to, I wouldn't even call it transparency at the time, but thinking about relationships with researchers. Then the 2016 election happens and all hell breaks loose. And I remember actually talking to you and some others at Facebook about the possibility of there being some kind of commission following the 2016 election. One thing led to another, and others were talking to Gary King, including Mark Zuckerberg at the time, Gary King, professor at Harvard, and others who talked to Larry Kramer at the Hewlett Foundation. And to make a long story short, what came out of that was not necessarily a commission to study the 2016 election, but to think of a structure for research to be done on Facebook in an organization which we called Social Science One, which also involved the Social Science Research Council and Alondra Nelson, who was the head of it back then. And so starting in 2017 or 18, we started working on trying to figure out a way to get data out of Facebook into the hands of the world's research community. So I flew around the world, trying to get interest with or gin up interest among researchers. And we started working with Facebook on like what data set might be made available to researchers. And it proved to be an incredibly difficult task because anytime we would talk about, the data that we wanted, the Facebook lawyers and others would complain about privacy. Remember, this is following the Cambridge Analytica scandal and literally in the middle of our effort.
Oh yeah, haven't forgotten. Those scars still
Facebook
go deep.
Facebook had to spend, $5 billion on a fine there. And so I had worked on setting up Social Science One. We did produce one of the largest social media data sets ever made available through that project, but it was highly aggregated data that was not necessarily what we would want as outside researchers. And I had all these privacy protections and noise put into it. Anyway, those frustrations that surrounded the development of Social Science One led me to think that, look, we've got to regulate in this area. And part of it is because there are well-meaning people like you at Facebook who would be fine with giving outside access to data. But anytime you hit either, the comms or in particular, the legal folks, it's hard for me as a researcher to say, hey, it's in your interest to be more transparent. And they're like, well, we just paid a $5 billion fine for, privacy violations. And so we needed some kind of legal equity on the other side of the balance there. And so I worked then with some lawyers to try to craft a law or a bill, which at that time was called the Platform Transparency and Accountability Act. Now it's the Platform Accountability and Transparency Act, PATA, which was introduced. I released it the day that Frances Haugen was testifying in the Senate. And then others sort of put a lot of stuff into it. Brandon Silverman, you mentioned from CrowdTangle, was instrumental in some of the language, as well as a few others. And Senator Coons from Delaware, Senator Portman was a Republican who from Ohio who also co-authored it and Amy Klobuchar. And basically and now we have several other Republican and Democratic co-sponsors. And it's basically trying to, develop a system, both for researcher access, but for public disclosures from the platforms.
And where is that at now in Congress? I mean, like most everything, there's not much happening in Congress,
It is where most everything is, right? Which is that it's sort of in limbo. I'll say two things have happened, which is that I wasn't under any illusion that, hey, just because professors want to have a bill, then suddenly Congress is going to stand up and act on it, right? My thinking about this is that it was always more likely to pass as an add-on to something else. So for instance, the COSA, the Kids Online Safety Act, that has now a research component that's been thrown into it. And if there's a serious attempt to deal with other tech issues that maybe there would be, you'd sort of take this and throw it on there. So on its own, I don't think it's going to get passed anytime soon. I thought maybe with the TikTok bill that's going through Congress that maybe there'd be some opportunity there, but that really hasn't. That's only been focused on trying to divest TikTok. So that's where things are in the U.S. But the good news is through the effort of people like Rebecca Trombley at GW, Europe has moved very, you know, much faster in this direction. So Article 40 of the Digital Services Act has all kinds of researcher access provisions. And so the transparency parts of the DSA are actually, I think, the most important parts of it. And so European academics, at least, are going to have the ability to do research on these platforms. And hopefully some Americans might be able to, you know, be on those teams.
Are there any early reports from researchers and others in Europe about how is the DSA doing what everybody hoped the DSA hoped it would do, or is it still too early to tell?
It's still too early. I mean, they're trying to develop the kind of structure to enable privacy protected researcher access to data. I mean, one thing that my preference when it comes to how this should get off the ground is that we should start with one big data set for each of these platforms, just like an exposure data set, which will not answer all the questions. But you mentioned CrowdTangle before, something like CrowdTangle, but for both public and private posts. And throw in all the privacy protection that you need, and then also surveil the researchers as they access these data. But start with a data set that then researchers can propose research projects to. Because the way the DSA is supposed to work is that, let's say you're an Irish academic, you would propose to the digital services coordinator of Ireland a research project. They would then evaluate it to see, you know, whether it's proper. And then they would tell the platforms what data they need to turn over or something along those lines. And that's going to be a kind of cumbersome process if you have these bespoke data sets that are coming out for each research request. As we learned with the development of Social Science One, really just getting the infrastructure right, figuring out how the people are going to access this data is going to be 90% of the difficulty. So let's start with like the kind of data set that most people want, which is about, say, you know, who saw what or engaged with what, when, and why. And that's kind of like what the CrowdTangle was thinking about. And then we can move to the more exotic data sets after that.
Can you dig into that a little bit more about, for people who might not be familiar, like what type of data are the researchers looking for? What are you hoping to study? And I'm also curious what you thought about. So another thing Facebook did was all this research around the 2020 election. We've only seen, I think, 4 of the 16 of those pieces. But Mike Wagner, the rapporteur from University of Wisconsin-Madison, wrote this piece about how the challenges they even had of knowing what to even ask for with the data. And so I was wondering if you could dig into that a little bit more of like, what exactly are you all trying to study? And are you confident that you know even what to ask for?
So the 2020 election studies, which were sort of an offshoot of Social Science One, because it was the committees, the U.S. and I think the Disinformation Elections Committees of Social Science One ended up sort of going in that direction. That was about experiments, right? So what the access that they had, that's the gold standard. I mean, and it was a very expensive project that Facebook put together. And I don't know whether they're ever going to do something like that again. And it's produced, you know, very important research that on polarization, disinformation, and other things. But what the kind of data that I'm talking about is just to start with is just some of the basic exposure data that people want. So we know, like I said, who saw or engaged with what, when, and why. Meaning what groups of people and what parts of the world are seeing or engaging in various ways with what kinds of content and when and why. Why being, you know, is it algorithmically fed to them? Is it ads? Is it otherwise, you know, why are they being exposed to it? And so that's just the basics so that we understand all the basic phenomena about social media and online political communication. There are as many research topics as there are researchers. And so there are researchers who want to study comments, or researchers who want to, you know, study, you know, particularly things about ad exposure, people who want to look at bias, all that kind of stuff. But the core of people's interest is just to figure out like what people are being exposed to certain types of communication online. And so I think we need to start there. It's not going to answer every question, but it is like, as you're saying, the deprecation of CrowdTangle is a real concern as we approach this election. But that data set was basically just looking at engagement. One of the reasons I think it was controversial inside Facebook is that it was looking at engagement and content, and then people were interpreting it as if it was providing data on exposure, like what people were seeing. But really, it was about what people were liking, what people were thumbs upping, all that kind of stuff.
Well, let's shift over to the Supreme Court, because there's been quite a bit happening in the courts as well. They recently heard arguments in Murphy v. Missouri. They also heard arguments in NetChoice. Where are you sitting right now with where you think the court's going to rule on these?
And they also released an opinion in this case, Linky.
Yes.
So this is, it really is amazing to see how, you know, the courts work, and they work quite slowly as a general rule. So we haven't had many internet cases over the last, you know, 20 years. And now we have three blockbuster cases in one term where the court is going to potentially rewrite the rules of the internet. And so as a general rule, I've been impressed with the oral arguments in these cases in terms of the diversity of viewpoint among the justices. This could be a nice situation where we don't get the predictable liberal conservative split on some of these issues, because they're still working it through. The biggest cases, I think, are the NetChoice cases, because these are cases that look at whether the Texas and Florida laws that are going to require platforms to carry certain speech, whether those are constitutional under the First Amendment. So, for example, if Facebook wanted to kick a candidate off its platform because of hate speech, they would not be able to do that in Florida, or even to take down the speech. And I mean, this has profound implications in across many domains. One is just, you know, whether the extent of the First Amendment rights of platforms and their right to moderate. But also the idea that we might be breaking up the internet into 50 component parts in the United States will also be quite important, because if this is upheld, I bet you there's a California law in waiting that would also regulate content. But as we were talking about before, like the DSA in Europe is happening at the same time. And so we may end up being in a world by this summer where there's certain types of content that is required in Florida, that is illegal in Europe, and that's optional everywhere else. And so it puts the platforms in a real difficult position. So that's the one that I'm watching. Then there's the Murphy versus Missouri one that you mentioned before, which is about so-called jawboning, whether the government overreached when it was chastising Facebook and other platforms related to COVID and the elections. And it seemed to me that the justices are trying to walk the very difficult line that we all are trying to walk as to, you know, when is the government allowed to significantly encourage actions on the platforms or to notify them about dangerous content, as opposed to threatening them with, you know, legal or, say, antitrust actions. And then, you know, they'll come up with some muddled standard, and then, well, you know, each administration will have to try to work through it.
I'm curious if you agree with one of my predictions, which is there's a chance that, like you said, something has to stay up in Florida. It's illegal in Europe. It's optional everywhere else. And you have this hodgepodge of court rulings, state laws, what's happening in Europe and other places. Could that finally be the thing that makes Congress act in the next Congress to finally do a national level law?
I suppose so. The problem is that it's not clear to me what law, say, in this domain, related actually to content moderation and speech, you could get Congress to be bipartisan on, right? Because even if it's true that we're getting sort of 50 walled gardens in the U.S. with related to the internet, the Democrats and the Republicans have very different concerns when it comes to content online. And so to get them to coalesce together on some kind of reasonable proposal is going to be very, very difficult. And I mean, you know, as a general rule, the Democrats want to take down more stuff. The Republicans want to leave up more stuff, but it's more complicated than that. And so one would hope that there would be a national law that at least would say, hey, you know, we can't have 50 different rules related to speech online. But we'll see. It really depends, not just what the U.S. Supreme Court says in these cases, but how it says it. You know, where does it draw the lines between what is permissible state action, what's impermissible? I'll note the irony that between these two cases, that the advocates tend to take inconsistent positions here. So those folks who are most embracing of the law in, say, Florida or Texas are also most fearful of government action in the jawboning context. And so it is sort of strange that you know, we may come up with rules that both, you know, constrain the federal government when it tries to cajole internet platforms, but is more permissive with what are really serious intrusions on their practices when it comes to content moderation in Florida and Texas.
What, there's hypocrisy and contradiction happening in politics? I'm shocked. Well, shocked.
Not just politics, but you know, at the court, it's going to be interesting to see how they navigate those concerns, because there's a group of justices who are, if not ready to treat Facebook like a state actor, at least are very concerned about how big, powerful corporations are regulating speech. And then to think about, you know, what should be the constitutional principles that allow us to treat them differently than your other kind of Citizen United protected corporation. And then there are those who are, you know, muddling through the safety issues and what the First Amendment rights of these big platforms should be.
Now, beyond the Supreme Court, there's a lot of other cases working their way through the states and the appellate courts and stuff like that. Do you suspect that this is only the beginning of the Supreme Court hearing a lot of these cases? Do you think that this is, like, where do you think we are in the court's role of all of this in this conversation about regulating tech?
I think the court is going to be central, and that's because the other, at least at the federal government, the other political branches are not able to function. And so the court is going, the strangeness about these three big cases this year is, I think, you know, these kinds of issues were potentially in the pipeline for a long time, but it just takes, you know, the Supreme Court is kind of a lagging indicator. Most of the cases that dealt with the internet, if you go back to the early 2000s or just before, that the court heard had to do with pornography and you know, online decency issues. But they've never had, like, much in the way of, say, a Section 230 case. Last year, they had you know, the Gonzalez versus Tomna cases involving, you know, whether Twitter and others could be held liable for extremist content that was on their platforms. And, you know, one would have thought that maybe that would be a case that should have come up decades ago to resolve those kinds of issues. But the courts, you know, are just now getting this glut of cases. And so they're going to be, yeah, this is just the beginning. The floodgates have just opened, and we're going to have, I think, a series of cases every year.
Lastly, I want to shift to election administration and that type of work that you mentioned that you do, especially since we've got a huge year of elections around the globe. You've played some interesting roles, including one about being a special master for redistricting. What is that? It's a very cool title.
Actually, behind me, well, I've got some of my ballots behind me. There's an Abraham Lincoln ballot there. This is an old voting machine over here. One of the reasons I got appointed to be the research director of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration is that I had never been a member of a political party. And then I had been appointed for the previous, decade or so by courts to resolve redistricting disputes. And sometimes, as you said, as a special master. And so that's where Ben Ginsburg sort of knew me from. And I think Bob Bauer as well. As of the last Congress, I had been, you know, participating. Worked for courts. I drew, I think, roughly 12% of the congressional districts from the last cycle. And I was the special master this time in Connecticut and in New Hampshire, and worked with the commissions in Utah, Maryland, and got appointed in some other local jurisdictions. So I've drawn districts for many, many states, and I'm one of the few people, I think, who knows the law, knows the technology, knows the political science on this, and didn't have a partisan track record. And so my first appointment was back in 2001 or 2002, drawing the congressional districts for New York. And through long sort of convoluted train of events, there was almost no one in the country who was not conflicted out, who actually did this stuff. Because everyone who does this as a business, you know, would work for the Democrats or Republicans. But I didn't have a track record because I was a pretty young, new professor at Penn at the time. And so got appointed to that. It was widely seen as, I think, Republicans and Democrats hated the plan, but it was widely seen as nonpartisan. That led to me being appointed in Maryland, then Georgia, and then we're off to the races. and I get appointed, you know, with relative frequency. I think I'm sort of finding this a little bit exhausting these days. I'm getting old. I don't know if I can continue to do that. But like I said, that work ended up then transferring to be the research director because they wanted a nonpartisan person for the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. And so then that led to a whole suite of work related to the nuts and bolts of elections. And then I had sort of taken that hat off and been working on the tech space since I came to Stanford and we started the Cyber Policy Center. But when the pandemic happened in 2020, through sort of urgings of the Hewlett Foundation and others, I decided with Charles Stewart, who's a professor at MIT and really the foremost expert on what we call election sciences, he and I started something called the Stanford MIT Healthy Elections Project, which was to study all of the issues related to election administration as the pandemic emerged.
And what are some of the ways that you all have seen about how election administration needs to be improved? And how are you hoping like technology might play a role in doing that?
So election administration right now is facing, election administrators are facing unprecedented challenges. We enter the 2024 election with a sort of perfect storm of problems. We have every state, for the most part, has changed its election laws since 2020, some to make it more sort of permissive in voting with things like absentee ballots and early voting, others to make it somewhat more restrictive, but they've almost all changed their laws. And we have a record number of election officials who have resigned since then in the face of death threats, other kinds of scrutiny. And so you've got novice election officials interpreting ambiguous laws at a time when there's been a complete collapse in a partisan collapse in confidence in the electoral system. And so the fact that a majority of Republicans believe that the 2020 election was rigged and that you can't trust the election infrastructure has, you know, real implications for the jobs of these election officials who now are seen as part of a deep state conspiracy by, you know, tens of millions of Americans. And so that's the situation we find ourselves in. Then you lop onto that the new technologies, right? So that we talked about the AI questions related to deepfakes, synthetic media, and their intersection with social media. And I think that those, that puts election administrators naturally on their back feet. But I think, you know, what we need to do is really have clear rules. Even if they're not the optimal rules that are easily interpretable by election officials, protect them and try to pull off this election. On the technology side for them, I think that, you know, AI, and this is true for the platforms as well, right? AI can be used as a defensive measure as well as an offensive measure to deal with things like disinformation and other kinds of threats to the electoral system, like anomaly detection and, sussing out fraud and other problems. So that's, I think, where you're going to see it. I personally believe that the most dangerous kinds of disinformation technologies, deepfake video, are not really going to be ready for prime time for the 2024 election. That doesn't mean we won't see thousands of them. They already are out there. I mean, if you put Trump or Biden into Twitch, you will see that there is a 24-hour-a-day debate between avatars of Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Those who are listening, don't do this at work because it's a kind of not safe for work debate that's happening where trolls are throwing in all kinds of profane questions. But the point is that there are going to be millions of examples of deepfake videos, but they're not as undetectable as things like the image generation tools, which now are, you know, pretty much perfect.
Amazing. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining us. Just lastly, how can people follow along in your work? What's the best place for them to see what you're doing and stay up to date?
So join the Cyber Policy Center's email list. So just put Stanford Cyber Policy Center into Google. We have Tuesday seminars every week that I moderate with leading lights. You've done one of them. Thank you, Katie. But then also my website is personally.com.
Great. And I'll put all those links on the show notes as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Impossible Trade-Offs. You can find the show notes and everything for this podcast on my Substack at anchorchange.substack.com. I want to thank my guests for doing this, and this episode was edited by Claude Jennings Jr. I hope you all have a great day, and thank you so much.